Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Tales from the Heart, a podcast from the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Association. Just want to give a shout out to all of our sponsors and thank them for the support of this program and of the HCMA in general. So thank you to our sponsors at Bristol-Myers Squibb, Cytokinetics, Tenaya Therapeutics, BioMarin, Edgewise, Embrya, and soon a few more names are added to the list. And it is a unique podcast day, as it is my first day back in the office in a week. And I have just experienced an unusual complication of my transplants. And I'm going to walk you through that program, what happened to me in the past week during our program today. The month of March, we dedicate to arrhythmia education. I didn't mean to be an active participant in the educational process with my own story, but it turns out that I did. I'm going to bring up to the stage in just a few moments Dr. Harry Lever, who is going to engage with a conversation on all the arrhythmias that can happen in HCM and some things that can happen in other cases. And we're going to spend a little bit of time today talking about the other end of arrhythmias, which we don't talk about too much here, bradyarrhythmias or slow heart rates. So I am going to welcome to the stage Dr. Harry Lever. Good morning, Dr. Lever. Welcome to
Tales. Good morning. Morning.
First of all, could you explain to our listeners what a bradyarrhythmia is?
It means an abnormal slowing of the heart rate. Usually occurs with what we call heart block, where the impulses do not get transmitted from the upper chambers, the atria, down into the ventricle because there's some electrical wire problem. It can make people pass out when it happens. It's not as malignant as ventricular tachycardia, but it certainly can be a bad problem and make people pass out.
I'm going to do something I don't always do on Tales from the Heart, and I'm going to turn the story onto some experiences that I have had recently. And those of you who follow me on social media, I took you along on this journey this week. About 4 months after my heart transplant, which was February of 2017, I experienced an odd symptom. It just felt very different than an HCM-related problem that I had had previously. But I just felt like my blood pressure would drop out. It felt a little like orthostatic intolerance, but not quite. The best way I can put it is it felt like somebody unplugged my body and I was losing all my energy. It would last for a couple of seconds and then it would go away. And I would question myself whether or not this really just happened. I have traumatized my husband because every time it would happen, I would call his name. And he would come running and he knows that tone in my voice. And after about 15 or 20 seconds, it would be over. And after about a minute, I would be feeling normal again. And I would tell him to go about his day. Everything is fine now. So this had happened every 4 to 6 months since my transplant. It was a little unsettling. It would happen more so when I was at rest. It made it difficult to fall asleep because as I was falling asleep, it could happen and then it would trigger some anxiety because I don't know what this is, but I feel like I have intermittent heart block. But I could never prove it. And I didn't want to put a loop monitor in, but I knew I probably should have. In retrospect, I probably should have. So while I had COVID 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago now, I had a pulse ox on my finger because we all should have those at home for when we're sick to monitor our pulse oxygen level and our heart rate. And I had it on and my pulse ox was like in the high 90s, over 94, 95, 96. So I was fine. But I let it sit there for a little while, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, I got that feeling in the pit of my stomach, like I was a little nauseous, which is how mine starts, and then I felt the drop. And I looked down at my finger, and my heart rate went from 97 to 40. Boom. And then I watched it go 40, 40, 40, 45, 60, 90, and it went right back up. Damn it, I have intermittent heart block. So I call my transplant doc. I'm like, I caught it. And he's like, but I didn't see it. You need a monitor. I'm going to send you one. So about 4 days, 5 days later, this box shows up in my mail. This is a Philips monitor. I'm not endorsing Philips. I'm just telling you, this is the one that my team chose. I'm going to give you a demonstration. It comes with this little pack here that you open up. And the sticker is very small. It doesn't really have anything on it, but it has this little guy that attaches to it. I'm not, boom, boom, and you attach them. And it goes on, and then you pull off all the white, and it's clear. So it's a very subtle monitor. I had it on for a couple days. I took my first one off so I could take a shower and clean the site, moisturize, so it didn't get all irritated like they can do. Got a new one on, put the new one on Saturday. And it comes with a cell phone. that has an app that you send your reports, and that's how the device works. Saturday night last week, which, oh my God, I don't even know what day it is. So today minus six, I went to go to sleep, and going to sleep is my hardest time. I fell asleep, at least I think I did. And then all of a sudden I was awake and I could feel it happening again. So I smacked my husband, who's sleeping next to me, and I'm like, wake up, something's happening. This poor man, this poor, poor man. So he wakes up, he goes, who do I have to call? I'm like, give me a second. It's okay now, you can go back to sleep. So we both rolled over and went to sleep. I get a phone call 4:30 in the afternoon on Sunday from my team, transplant team, telling me, you need to go to the emergency room right now. I'm like, why? This happens intermittently. I'm fine. They're like, no, this was bad. Your heart stopped for 7 seconds. All right, you got my attention. 7 seconds. That's not bad. So I said, send me the report. I need to see what it did. And I was in complete AV block, like complete heart block. I got no beat for 7 seconds. I can see why they're upset. But I think that this has been happening intermittently for 6.5 years. I knew I bought myself a pacemaker. So I had to go to the hospital. I got a right and left heart cath and a biopsy to check my donor heart, make sure I wasn't in rejection. I'm not. My heart is perfect. Brandy is great. She just has this wonky intermittent heart block, bradyarrhythmia. Heart slows down, heart comes back on board. This can make you pass out. I did pass out about 3.5 years ago. I feel them, so I'm symptomatic. So I'm symptomatic heart block. And that requires a pacemaker. Due to the complications that are me, I cannot put anything in the upper chest where most of you have your pacemakers and defibrillators, because I've had so much trauma in this area that I don't have any vascular access. And the other side, frankly, I want to leave open in case I ever need a port in the future for anything related to my transplant or anything else that I might need. I have really, 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 really bad veins. And they believe me now because they put the vein finder on my arms in the hospital and they said, you don't have any. I said, I'm aware. So I have to get a midline. So all of that was going on. And I'm going to do something I don't normally do on podcasts. I'm going to stand up in a second because it's unbelievable what I had done. I was transferred from Morristown to NYU because Morristown doesn't really work on transplanted hearts. I went on Tuesday night. I got there at about midnight. The next morning, everybody's in my room. We got a plan. I thought I was going to have maybe a pacemaker inserted on Thursday. Nope, they put me on the end of the day. No, I couldn't eat all day and I might have been a little hangry, but I kept it to myself. And I went into the lab at 4:30. Got out at 5:30. There was pudding waiting for me. I'll explain that one later. And at 9:30, I was allowed to get up and walk around, and I'm waiting for some pain. Like, I'm waiting for that limp after a cath. I walked across the room. There was literally no pain. No pain. I'm going to stand up now. Ta-da. I can stand. I can move. I can do whatever I want, except for squat. And I got a leadless pacemaker inserted inside of my heart. There's two good devices out there. There's a Medtronic and then there's the Abbott. This, whoop, there we go. Abbott Advair. That's the one I went with. Why did I choose the device that I chose? Because it screws into the heart and thereby at some point you might be able to unscrew it a little bit easier than the Micra, which is from Medtronic, which has like little tongues that go out. So the way it connects to the heart's a little bit different. The Abbott device, if I needed dual chamber pacing, I would be able to put in another device in the atria and I could have dual chamber pacing wirelessly. So I am back to being battery operated along with many of you. Different reason, different battery operation. And that's what happened to me this week. And that's how my bradycardia and my heart block was treated. It's been a wild week. If you told me that I'd be able to leave the hospital, talk to Dr. Lever while driving through Manhattan, while my husband was driving, I should say. I stopped in Chinatown. I picked up my favorite guilty pleasure treat, Chinese pork buns, my lunch today. All right, maybe not totally heart healthy, but I think I earned it this week. Got home, took a nap from 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock, woke up, put my sneakers on and took a 2-mile walk around the lake. That is less than 24 hours from when I had the device implanted. I took a 2-mile walk, up hills, down hills, all around Lake Tullamore. And I'm back to work today. And I look a lot better than last time you saw me on camera because like I'm back to me now. So it's been a crazy week. Last Friday, I was in New York City at the American Society of Echoes HCM kind of think tank, working with some of my good friends on how to make echoes even better for every aspect of HCM. And I didn't expect to be back in patient zone by Sunday night, but I was. I shared the journey with you. If you want to go see more details, I kind of chronicled it all on Facebook and Instagram, so you can share the story along with me. You know, I'm fully transparent about my heart health. I kind of thought I would need a pacemaker, but when they said it's real, I'm like, wow, I'm going to do this again. I think my body just likes modern technology. So I've got a leadless pacemaker that should last between 15 and 20 years because I'm going to hardly use it. And there we go. So, Dr. Lever, bradyarrhythmias. What are the signs and symptoms? I know what mine were, but what are the general signs and symptoms of somebody who has intermittent heart block or bradyarrhythmias? What do people typically feel?
You tend to feel lightheaded. And, you know, it's different than there's another kind of dizziness called vertigo that occurs because of a problem in the middle ear. And that makes you feel like you're spinning. That's different than this. This is just basically a slowing of the heart rate and you feel dizzy. The blood pressure goes down.
HCM patients don't typically experience heart block, but it can happen. We do have some people who have heart block, maybe caused by a myectomy, maybe caused by an alcohol septal ablation and myectomy. So there are some patients who really only need pacing. If they are a patient who only needs pacing, these wireless devices might be an option, but that would be rare for HCM. It would be more common to need a device that can offer dual chamber pacing and defibrillation.
And the interesting thing is that if people go into problem, if they have a start with a right bundle branch block and then go on to need an alcohol ablation or a myectomy, the incidence of needing a pacemaker is almost 100%. The heart has two bundles, a right and a left. The right takes care of the right heart and the left takes care of the left heart. And if something happens, if your right is out because it's been that way for a long time, and then we have to do something to you, like do surgery or an alcohol ablation, there's a high incidence of needing a pacemaker. So that's what depends on how you start out.
Yesterday, before I left the hospital, the Abbott team came in and they interrogated the device and they tested it. And I felt that pacing, they turn it up, ramp it up, make sure it's capturing. I literally started laughing. I'm like, I never thought I would feel this again. I thought this was done, but it's reassuring to know that it was capturing. This doesn't have telemetry monitoring yet. Hey, Abbott people, let's get on that telemetry monitoring. It would be a lot more convenient. But I'll wait. But it's just been a wild journey. I am absolutely in awe of medical technology. I thank everybody who's worked to help create this technology and others. Proof we need clinical trials, proof we need safe devices. It would be wonderful if we could get a pacer defib that could implant in the same manner. There's no pain, guys. There's literally no pain. It's amazing. That was my bradyarrhythmia issue. Now I want to pivot to things more specific to hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and that is risk assessment for sudden cardiac arrest in HCM. Dr. Lever, what do patients need to evaluate about their hearts to know whether they have an increased risk of a life-threatening arrhythmia?
It's coming down to looking to see how much scar you have. We do MRI scans. Pretty much most patients, probably all patients now with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, get an MRI scan. And we try to quantitate how much scarring there is. And if it's above 15%, That's a significant amount, and that's what we look at patients to put in defibrillators. The MRI has been very helpful in telling us what patients have, and it's something we didn't, numbers of years ago, we didn't have it. Now we have it, and it's very helpful.
In addition to scarring, which we know is a major risk factor, what are the other risk factors that we look at?
We look for ventricular tachycardia. And if there's a lot of ventricular tachycardia, you're at risk.
What about family history risk?
Yeah, that too. I mean, I think that if there's an increased risk in the family, then we look very carefully at the other family members to see if what they have. And, you know, it tends to all go together. If the genetic makeup and all, you as a family, you may have an increased risk of that. And if that's the case, then we're putting in more defibrillators.
Massive hypertrophy of the heart?
Yes, above 30 millimeters.
So there's been some debate and questioning lately about body surface area or BSA or age and height and weight and all these factors. Younger people who have thicker walls and you use the Z score to determine how thick it should be, they may not reach that 3.0 level, but right, they could be like the 2.5 five, six, seven, depending upon their size.
Right.
And that could indicate risk too, correct?
Right.
So we have family history. We have ventricular arrhythmias, mostly non-sustained ventricular tachycardia. We have scar on MRI. We have massive hypertrophy.
I think you also have to be concerned about atrial fibrillation. And if you have episodes of atrial fibrillation, and particularly if it goes very fast, that can cause ischemia in the heart. And that might be another reason to have a run of ventricular tachycardia after the AF gets started. So you got to be concerned about that.
And then there's the rare group who were kind of like the me pre-transplant, heading to transplant, lower ejection fraction. Right. Those individuals have a risk based on probably the fact that they got a ton of scar. They're heading towards an advanced heart failure. We're going to try to stop using the term end-stage disease, and we're going to call it advanced heart failure in HCM, because end-stage just sounds so final. But there is a pathway for those who have advanced heart failure in the face of HCM. In terms of arrhythmia management, what medications could be used to help lower the risk of arrhythmias in those with HCM?
We're still using a lot of beta blockers, and that seems to be of some benefit. You got to be careful which beta blocker you're put on and who's making it and where they're making it and all that. We actually had a patient not too long ago who was switched from a good brand of metoprolol to a bad one, and within a few weeks developed heart failure. Ejection fraction was dramatically going down. He was a non-obstructive patient. He got in, it really got into trouble, and it was decided he had been stable for a long time. Once the beta blocker was changed, he went into heart failure and was decided he needed a defibrillator. Subsequently, the defibrillator did go off. And when I heard about what had happened, the brand was changed. He was put back on good stuff. And believe it or not, the ejection fraction picked back up. You got to be careful about that.
I'm going to dive into the beta blocker question in more detail in just a moment. But other drugs that might be able to treat arrhythmias, amiodarone, hardcore.
Yes, but you got to be careful with amio, because it has lots of side effects. And it's not to say we don't use it, but you've got to really follow the patient very carefully. It can cause problems with the lungs. It can cause problems with the thyroid. And you have to really watch the patient. You've got to be doing lung function studies. You got to do chest x-rays. You got to do thyroid function tests. It's not a simple drug. And when we use the drug, although it's very helpful, it's particularly helpful in atrial fibrillation. It'll work with ventricular tachycardia too. But when we use that drug, we try to use the lowest dose possible so that patients don't try to reduce the incidence of trouble. It's not just something you just give somebody. You got to be very careful with it.
Sometimes I don't quite know what we're going to talk about on Tales from the Heart. But as we bring up the topic of amiodarone, some people know the story of my sister, Lori, who passed away in 1995. And I often just refer to it as mismanaged HCM. The truth is, my sister was put on high dose amiodarone for very malignant arrhythmias. When they put her on the amiodarone, they never did the follow-up test. They never checked the thyroid levels. They never checked the lung toxicity. They never checked her eyesight. They didn't do any of the things that they were supposed to do. And somebody then put her on double diuretics. She was on two different diuretics that worked on two different manners of getting fluid off. She was in heart failure. She dropped out her potassium to a dangerous level. Her potassium was under 1 when she got to the hospital. So my sister died from complications of HCM, but it was amiodarone toxicity in the end that really did her in. You know, she had her arrest. We got her back. She had such brain damage that there was nothing left. So my sister became an organ donor because of amiodarone. My sister should have gone to transplant even in 95. That should have been the path for her, but nobody identified it. And instead, she was on 400 milligrams of amiodarone, which is way too high. Ooh. And the person who put her on 400 milligrams of amiodarone also published an article stating that high dose amiodarone is dangerous in HCM, but that's exactly what it did to my sister. That's a topic for another podcast where we'll dive into that topic in another day. Amiodarone is a great drug if it doesn't kill you. So be careful and manage it very, very well. Other drugs, what about Teicosin, dofetilide?
That can work, but we're not using it that much, I don't think.
I have two people who have loaded on it in the past 2 weeks, and mostly for atrial arrhythmias.
Right.
It has a place, but you try the other stuff first because it's a little difficult to load. You got to do it in the hospital. Right. Yes, you can feel better, and yes, it can work for some people, and we hope those two individuals are doing very well. Hi, guys. What else do we need to know about treating arrhythmia, ventricular arrhythmias?
If we're worried about ventricular arrhythmias, that's when we need to have the defibrillator. And then what we also need to do, though, is try to keep the heart rate slow so that and that's where the beta blockers again.
We talked a little bit about the quality of beta blockers, and those who are Dr. Lever followers know that you are very passionate about the quality of generic drugs. I'm very happy to say that there is available name brand Toprol XL in the United States now. The little change that we're going to have to get used to in this space is the current distributor of Toprol XL is a company called Melenta. They're actually based here in New Jersey. I met with them a couple of weeks ago. I have a follow-up meeting with them next week to get into the more specifics on how you can access their drug. There's no more authorized generic in the United States. It's name brand or generic. That's the way they're going to be distributing this. And with a discount code, you'll be able to get Metoprolol name brand Toprol XL without your insurance for about $20 to $30 a month. And you know that it's going to be the real thing and it's going to be good quality. I think we need to do a whole session on how to identify the manufacturer of your drug. I was looking for a pill bottle to see if I had one around. Oh, look, I just happen to have a pill bottle in here. It's amoxicillin. This is for my dental work that was supposed to be done this week that I didn't get to go to. But in the corner at the bottom of my bottle, there's a manufacturer name. I have to admit, I haven't checked this one yet, which is silly of me because my husband picked it up from the pharmacy. It's normally the first thing I do because there's certain manufacturers that I want to stay away from. And my eyes aren't working so good and I can't find the manufacturer on this bottle, which is part of the problem. We're going to do the glasses thing. Harry, while I'm looking for the manufacturer and so I can show people where the label is, could you talk about why manufacturer knowledge is important?
Because a lot of it's coming from India and China, and there's been a lot of manufacturing problems. Every medicine, every tablet, I should say, is assigned an NDC number. And you can look that up in a program called Daily Med. You put the number, the NDC should be put on the label when it comes from the pharmacy. And if it does, then you look that number up and it'll tell you who the manufacturer is for that tablet. There is another program called drugs.com that has a picture of tablets. Each tablet has a small, not the NDC, but there's other markings on a tablet. You look at the tablet, you put in the letters and numbers that are on the tablet, and it'll tell you where the drug is coming from, who is the repackager or who the manufacturer is. And that's very helpful. That's how I've done it over the years. And then the NDC is supposed to be out there for every drug. But unfortunately, pharmacies don't always put the NDC number on the label like they're supposed to. So that's why drugs.com has a picture of actually what you see. You can look that up. So it's important to identify. And I always tell patients, when you go to the pharmacy to pick up your medicine, if you've been stable on a medicine, do not let that pharmacy change the manufacturer, because that's how we get into trouble. But sometimes the pharmacies get very stubborn, and that's when you got to go to another one. If they're starting to switch, and that's something that's going to have to be changed in the law. A pharmacy should not be allowed to change a drug manufacturer without talking to the physician. As a matter of fact, there is a law in the state of Utah that says that, but it's only for seizure drugs. Seizure drugs in the state of Utah are not allowed to be changed by a pharmacy unless they get the okay of the physician, because you can have breakthrough seizures. But the whole thing needs to be changed. And that should be that way for all drugs. If you're on something stable, we should not change it.
This is going to get interesting, Harry. I did not check my manufacturer until right now, and I found something quite interesting. And I am not making any comments about the company. They may be a perfectly fine company, but I don't like this practice. And unfortunately, my state has allowed it. So the manufacturer is called Citron. Citron. So when you look them up, it looks like they're a New Jersey company. Mm-mm. It says that their headquarters is in East Brunswick, New Jersey.
Nope.
Well, that's where their office is, mm-hmm. But that's not where the drugs are made. We don't make generic drugs in New Jersey. But we are the medicine chest of the world, because New Jersey has a lot of pharma, but we're not doing a lot of manufacturing here. You have to dig a little deeper to find out where your drug was made. And based on the corporate structure and some of the names of the founders, I'm going to have to do a deeper dive. I do believe that these drugs were made in India, although they appear like they were made in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. We need truth in manufacturing labeling. We need to know where these drugs are found. No disrespect to the people of India. Lots of wonderful people living in India, lots of great science, and maybe some good generic manufacturers. But the FDA has no ability to just pop in and inspect, because they have to make an appointment, and that can take 3 to 4 months for them to get the appointment to inspect the facilities. And I think it's really important that we bring drug manufacturing back to the United States so that we can have proper oversight and make sure that we are providing good quality drugs to the American people. You can ask for another prescription of antibiotics and we'll figure that one out. But it's really important for you to do the dive on your drug manufacturer so that you know where things are coming from, whether it's your cardiac meds or otherwise. You want to know the quality. And Dr. Lever and I will be talking in coming weeks about some other efforts to evaluate generic drugs. And we have some exciting news that we'll be bringing you probably in the next 3 to 4 months on this very topic. So please stay tuned. We'll tell you more. Harry, what are the best generic brands for metoprolol?
Probably the best one is Melinta right now. That is the authorized generic. It's really made by the original company, AstraZeneca.
So just to be clear, it is not authorized generic. It's a real name brand. They don't.
Well, have- yeah, but that's what. But yeah, I understand that. But Melinta itself, they some of those their people are calling it authorized generic. But it's basically AstraZeneca.
So a question was asked, and I have to give you a little bit more education before I answer the question. Where a name brand drug is made is a little less important than a generic drug, and that is because name brand is name brand. It's the original, it's the OG, it's the way it goes, right?
Right.
That's what we're trying to match. Generics. Generic Drug Act requires that the generic be between 80 and 120% of the original.
Right.
Of the original formulation. The people who make the original formulation of any drug are not required to hand over the recipe to a generic manufacturer. So the generic manufacturers are kind of, they take the meds and they break them down and then they build them back up because they don't have the actual recipe. My drug that I take for my heart transplant, tacrolimus, there's a lot of generic manufacturers out there and there've been some problems. In fact, I think a couple of my friends back in about 2016, 17, may have actually gone into rejection because their drugs were such poor quality and they didn't know to go get their blood values checked to see where their tacrolimus levels were. And people got in a lot of trouble from bad tacrolimus. My most recent manufacturer and the one that I stuck with the whole time, because of course my insurance company doesn't want to pay for name brand, they want to pay for generic. I used a company called Accord and I was always on Accord. But I noticed my tacrolimus levels were going up, 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 which for me can put my kidneys at risk. So you got to keep watching these numbers. And I'm like, what's going on? Well, I get a notice saying we're not carrying Accord anymore because the FDA has pulled their ability to provide that drug because they couldn't keep consistent dosing. And they were overdosing people, which puts you into kidney failure. So thank you to the FDA. They pulled Accord from distributing drugs, but it took an awful long time to get there. And we need to do more work to make sure that it doesn't take that long to pull a drug from market when a generic manufacturer is a bad operator. So I had to fight with my insurance company. I now have to take name brand Prograf. Instead of costing me like $40, $50 for a 3 month supply, it's $120. If I go through my NYU specialty pharmacy, I only can get 30 days at $120 a bottle, and I take two different things, so it's $240 a month. If I go for a 90-day supply, I have to go to Optum, and I can get it for the same price because of PBMs and rebates and, excuse me, but the bullshit that is out there in drug pricing. Sorry, but not sorry. We've got to change things.
Oh, yeah.
This is ridiculous the way things are working, but that's another rant for another day. So know your manufacturer. Stay consistent on a manufacturer. Generics aren't all bad, but they are not as consistent as name brand.
The other thing that most people don't realize It's sometimes not even the drug itself that's the problem. It's the inactive ingredients. If they're not put in the right way or the right amount is not used, that's one of the reasons why there are problems with how the drugs are they absorb into the body. Clearly, the inactive ingredient, the name brand company is not telling anybody. And that's one of the major problems. It's really the inactive ingredient. And so one day I sat down and started looking at some of these different brands and I got an education. It was just different. They are different one to the next. And you got to also be careful, again, about the name of the company. They tend to put USA at the end of it. And it's not USA. That has to be changed also.
Truth in labeling. It has to be bigger than a 4-point font on the label. I could not read it. I had to get my glasses. I have had to take pictures and blow it up on my screen because these eyes are getting old. We need to really focus on the quality. Somebody asked about where is Kim's iOS manufactured. I'm not 100% sure where the manufacturing facility is. But again, it's name brand. Yeah. It's the original formula. It's what you need. So for that, it's not as important where it's manufactured. And most of them do manufacture out of the United States.
One other thing that you got to mention about generic drugs. The original law came out in 1984. And all the number of patients that had to be tested was about 25 to 30 patients. It wasn't like you had to check hundreds of bottles of drugs. It was just 30 to 40, you know, they had to test the drug in about 30 to 35 patients. That's it. And there's lots of difference between people. So you gotta, that has to be done more.
Let's talk about one other thing about 1984. Okay, I was in high school in 1984. I really liked 1984. The music was the best. But did we have extended release molecules in 1984?
Nope.
The science behind developing the molecules that allow you to take a once a day preparation are really, really complicated formulas. And if you don't get it right, you dilute the drug really fast or it doesn't dilute at all. So you might find if you're taking a generic drug and you're feeling good for 2 or 3 hours and then all of your symptoms come back, you may have dumped that drug already. You may have metabolized the whole thing and you're not going to take another dose for 8 or 10 hours. So specifically, if you have obstructive HCM and you take a drug and you have the drug on board for a few hours and then you lose it, your gradient's going back up when you have no drug on board. And you need to keep a consistent homeostasis. You need to make sure that that drug is being released on a regular basis and it's going out in little bits through your body. The Generic Drug Act does not take into consideration the extended release mechanism, something called the dissolution rate. You want to explain what a dissolution rate is, Harry?
That's how fast the drug is dissolved. And as a matter of fact, we recently studied tacrolimus. The two manufacturers that we looked at, or actually were more than we looked at, but of two of the ones that we were most worried about, they dissolved too quickly. And they didn't hang around long enough. And as a result, the patients weren't properly protected.
I was one such patient about 3 years ago. They didn't have the Accord that I mentioned earlier. So they said, we have to send you another generic manufacturer because I'm a Jersey girl. And they said, we have Sandoz. I was assuming that Sandoz was, you know, the same Sandoz that used to be down in East Hanover, New Jersey that I drove by all the time. And I'm like, okay, send me Sandoz. Well, Sandoz isn't manufactured in the United States. It was manufactured in India. And for the first time since my transplant, my tacrolimus levels dropped to below 5, which is therapeutic. I was like a 4.8 out of nowhere by changing my manufacturer. I think that was because the dissolution rate of that particular batch, that preparation, was poor. If you're on tacrolimus, if you're one of my transplant buddies, make sure you're checking your bottle. It's probably more important for you than somebody who takes metoprolol and they may become more symptomatic. You could literally die from going into rejection because your tacrolimus levels drop too low.
And you probably should be on the name brand.
It's a complicated thing. I know it's a little bit more expensive because it's going to be a tier 4 on a formulary. And I'm going to do a whole talk later this year on PBMs and formulary placement and the absolute, here I go again, bullshit that we're allowing as American citizens in this process. It is a joke. It is embarrassing. We have money being made on the sickest. And we're actually expected to pay higher rates so that the insurance companies can benefit more from the PBM contracts because expensive meds give them more money in their pocket while I'm still paying these higher out-of-pocket copays. We need a change. And I am all fired up on this one now. So get ready for a wild ride over the next couple of years, folks. We're going to make some serious change happen. Harry, let's pivot to atrial arrhythmias for a moment. Right. What is an atrial arrhythmia?
It's a type of rhythm that comes out of the upper chambers. Most of the ones we talk about, it's atrial fibrillation, which is a rapid, irregular beating of the heart. That can make patients with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy feel really bad. I have used atrial fibrillation as a sign that the heart is starting to get into trouble. And when we were, before some of the newer drugs, and we were looking at more patients to operate on, if somebody went into atrial fibrillation, that would be an indication for me that we needed to think about doing a septomyectomy in a patient who has outflow tract obstruction. So atrial fibrillation is a bad sign that the heart's really starting to get into trouble.
Can you talk about the importance of knowing one's left atrial dimension?
As the left atrium gets larger, then there's a greater incidence of atrial fibrillation. That again is when we're looking at patients that with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and they have outflow tract obstruction, they tend to have larger left atrium. And when we operate on those people to do the septomyectomy, we might do something to try to make that left atrium a little smaller. And as a matter of fact, there are new devices that there's something called the left atrial appendage. If you have atrial fibrillation, this atrial appendage is a little sac. And if the atrium gets large and you're in atrial fibrillation a while, you may form a clot in that left atrial appendage, and that can put you at risk for stroke. And that's why we have these little sacs that we put into these chambers to prevent that.
A lot of people have seen the commercials for a new device that can be deployed into the heart. And I get a lot of questions about it. It's called a Watchman, and there are a couple of other devices out there now. Right. They don't work so well in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And while the direct-to-consumer advertising might make you think that it is as effective as anticoagulation, it can have its problems too, and clots can get past it. But for those who have problems with blood thinners, anticoagulants, it can be an alternative treatment, but it is not exactly the same as an anticoagulant.
If we talk about atrial fibrillation, there's a number of anticoagulants out there. The most commonly, the oldest one is Coumadin. And Coumadin has one major advantage, but a number of disadvantages. The first advantage is that you can test your blood level, basically, and see where you stand. But it interacts with a lot of drugs, so you've got to be careful. Some of the newer drugs, unfortunately, we do not have good tests to see how well anticoagulated people are. And that worries me. It's going to be worrying me more even over the time, because as these drugs start going generic, I don't know what we're going to do. Nobody's talking about that yet. But as these drugs go generic, we're going to have to come up with some way to make sure that they're thinning the blood just like the original drug, original non-generic.
Eliquis and Xarelto.
Right.
And they're both about to come off patent.
Right.
And when something comes off patent, then they go generic.
Right.
And there are some of my friends out there that are like, yay, it's generic. It's going to be cheap. And I'm like, but at what price?
Price. That's right. If you can't not test the blood level of somebody with one of those drugs when they go generic, we're going to have huge problems. I mean, we haven't seen it yet. From what I know about drugs and so on, and the fact now we're dealing with a blood thinner, we're going to have problems. Somebody's going to have to come up with something, but nobody's talking about it.
Some of us are talking about it behind the veil, so it's not a public conversation yet.
No.
But we're trying to figure out what can be done.
Right.
And face it. Like, let's just talk about what we all want. We want good drugs. We want them inexpensive. And there's this, I'm going to say something controversial right now. Is everybody listening? I'm going to say something controversial. The big pharma companies are not to blame for drug prices. There, I said it. It is the system that we have allowed to perpetuate in the United States that is going to cause much more harm long term. I will do an entire educational session on this soon, but suffice to say, somebody brought up the price of Camzyos in the comments. I saw, but we were kind of flashing past that. Camzyos is very expensive. It's took a lot of money to develop. Yes, the manufacturer deserves to get their money back for development. Do I agree with the price? No, I think it came in a little too high, even at that point, but they didn't put me in charge of that one. They did what they did, and I'm glad that the drug is available. The price isn't really the price. Remember back in the 80s and 90s when you would go to a car dealership and you would say, that's a sticker price, but I want the tissue price because they're different. Same thing with drugs. We're not seeing reality in pricing. I challenge every one of my pharma friends and everybody in regulatory to demand transparency in pricing and show patients where the money's going, because it's not going back to pharma like you think it is. A piece of the pie, and a large piece of the pie, is going to the PBMs. They're just a middleman. They buy bulk, they sell to different payers, and that's how it's done, which is why insurance companies are creating their own PBMs and creating this linear integration so the money stays all in-house. And it's a shell game. Where's the money? Where's the money? Where's the money? We need to see where that money is going, because it's not going where you think it's going. And when there's rebating going on, don't you think the person who is the patient should understand where her rebates went and where that money is trailing? So we need transparency. We need that transparency regulated, and we need to see exactly where the money is going, because, ladies and gentlemen, it ain't going where you think it's going. And pharma's not the big bad guy. Sorry, PBMs are kind of like the devil right now. And yes, we need a good distribution method. Yes, maybe they can get 2 or 3% off the top, but it ain't 2 or 3%. It's a hell of a lot more. And when you're pricing a drug, get this one, people. This is going to make your blood boil. When a new drug comes to market and there's another drug in the class, you have to price your drug near the price of the other drug. Why is that? Because if you're not close and the PBM can make more money off the other drug, your drug's not going to get on formulary and your drug won't get on the insurance list. So they'll say, we're not paying for that one, but we'll pay for this one. It's wrong. And we've allowed it to perpetuate far too long. Members of Congress, members of the Senate, members of state legislative bodies, wake up, wake up. Please help us. We need transparency in pricing on our drugs. Oh my God, I'm coming off my soapbox now. Sorry, Harry. I went on a tangent.
That's true.
It is true. So as we conclude another podcast, Arrhythmia Management March, we're going to talk more about devices later in the month. Rhythm management devices and the technology that's in them is just absolutely fascinating. But before we run away, I want to just take a look at some of the comments that we have, because Harry, we have a few members of the Harry Lever fan club here, and I want to take a few moments to acknowledge that Tracy Dixon saying, hello, my husband Sean is a patient, and they adore you. And then we have another message from Leslie that husband and daughter, you were there too. Husband is one of those patients you're talking about, likely pathway to heart transplant. Leslie, please join us in the transplant pathway discussion group this Monday night. You can all sign up if you've been told that the transplant is in your future, or you might be heading that way, or you've been worked up, or you're listed, or you're post-transplant like me. I have a real special guest coming Monday night. It's Dr. Robert Pensack. He wrote a book called Raising Lazarus back in the early 90s, and he's a dear friend. He is a 32-year survivor with a heart transplant, and he's a freshly retired psychiatrist, so he has a really unique perspective. So come join us if you're heading towards transplant, or you've been to transplant. We'll be happy to share his insights there. Real quickly, we have 2 minutes. I'm going to go a little bit off. And I know we don't really know this, but I have some strong feelings about this one too. Migraine headaches in HCM, specifically migraine with aura. I was plagued by this since my teenage years up until my transplant, and I don't get them anymore. Everybody in my family who had HCM got migraines with auras. It is really bizarre. Do we have any idea like why there might be a connection between our hearts and this particular type of migraine? I'm about to do a survey on this.
One problem is that migraines are very common.
They're common, but the specifics of the type of migraine in the HCM community is migraine with aura. That aura is just something, I think there's a there, but I don't know what it is. I'm not smart enough to figure that one out yet. So any of my friends who work that crossover of cardiac, neurology, there's something there, people. We got to figure this one out. They were debilitating for me for very many years. And I know a member of my staff just was experiencing an aura the other day. We don't know. I think it's a real thing. I validate that it's happening to all you. I don't know the why. It does seem to respond to the other long-term migraine meds. So don't be afraid to talk to your HCM clinician about managing your migraines and making sure that your meds are compatible. with HCM. We'll work on that one. Oh, here we go. Here's another one. Plagued since she's a kid, and it's with Aura. And there's a lot of them out there. Migraine with Aura. We have another Harry lover here. Miss Harry Lover's Care. Oh. Karen says hi.
Hi.
So there we go. Anyone getting a septal myectomy should have a pacemaker or defibrillator is a question.
Only if you need it.
Yep. Same risk factors apply.
If you start out with a right bundle, you're gonna get a pacemaker, because we create a left bundle when we do that.
And I should bring up another fact, and that is the high volume surgical programs are really important here, because if somebody develops a VSD, a hole in their heart, you can cut through the electrical system and you can create the right and left bundle branch block in the surgical procedure itself. If a surgeon isn't very experienced in myectomy, you have a higher likelihood of getting a VSD. High volume care matters. Have you heard me say that before? Okay, wait, we have another one. This is an anonymous, so it's coming from the Facebook private group. He's the best, was my mother's and mine as well. So I don't know who that was, but there's a lot of Harry Lover love going on today. I hope you're enjoying it. We have a comment from one of the UK viewers that they can only get basic generics unless you react to a generic drug. My UK friends, you're going to have to advocate for yourself. I encourage you to reach out to the Cardiomyopathy UK group, and Joel and his team might be able to get involved in this battle as well. We need to make sure everybody has access to high quality drugs, no matter where in the world you live. I do specifically speak a lot to the American experience because I'm here in New Jersey and that's my focus point. But the international reach is really important to us. And if you're an HCM patient living outside of the USA, we are definitely interested in speaking to you if you want to be an advocate and you want to become part of our HCMA international programming. We are trying to build up more advocates worldwide in different countries. We're really happy to have Brazil on board. Yay, Brazil. We have Australia and we have Sweden and we have some other ones that are going to be coming on in the next couple of months. Stay tuned for more information on that. Dr. Lever, thank you so much for joining me yet again on another edition of Tales from the Heart. Thank you to all of our sponsors, and an amazing, huge shout out to the entire HCMA team, who this week had the bosses back and I didn't have to worry about anything in the office because I knew my team had it. Thank you all. And to everybody, I'm going to cry now. Ladies and gentlemen, the outpouring of love and support that you all gave me all week long. You got me. You are all great. I love you all. All my clinical friends, I'm calling like, okay, here's the scenario. Oh, by the way, it's me. Which device would you choose? And I was checking in with people all over the country, the Facebook community, the Instagram community, the LinkedIn community. Everybody like was sending me private messages and support. And I just kept doing, you know, little updates from the hospital where I look like crap, but oh well, I was there. So thank you all for your love and support and your constant, constant support through my entire journey since I decided to go full transparency at the time of my transplant to now. It's not always being transparent about things that are literally trying to kill you, but it certainly does give you the superpower of resiliency and wanting to get back out there. I'm back in the seat fighting for all you guys. Brandy is protected. I will be showing an x-ray soon on social of what this looks like inside of my heart. It's so weird to have something inside the ventricle, the right ventricle. So crazy. But I'll be showing that to you soon. Mwah. Thank you all. Have a great day. And thank you for joining us on another edition of Tales from the Heart.